It's my pleasure to introduce Peter Blegvad, who is an American success story, a Renaissance invention, an American dream, really. Recently, last week, in fact, he was on BBC Midweek with Libby Purvis, trying to explain a concept to her, which you will be talking about tonight, which is vaguely the idea, the connection between lost memory, or what he would call senility, with imagination. And he flummoxed Libby Purvis to an extent where she started fantasizing about herself as a stripper. And after that, point B, she said, "Do you really think you're on the wrong side of sanity?" And he didn't deny it. And she went on to explain that perhaps Peter didn't belong anywhere. It's a sort of compliment. And I feel that Warwick is the perfect host for him. A man who doesn't belong anywhere belongs here. And of course, some of you, quite a few of you, I'm sure, have encountered Peter before in Warwick. And every time he comes back, there may be some things he does that you've kind of remembered, but there's always something new. He's a sort of inventor. He's someone who doesn't sort of stay still. That's why he looks so damn young, I think. Circa 25, I'd say. And this is the only guy I know who actually, you know, can manage to turn the clock backwards. So in about 20 years' time, he'll be coming here in a pushchair. That is the power of invention. Just to briefly recap on his career, he is a singer, songwriter, and a cartoonist. And he created the Leviathan cartoon, which I still can't pronounce properly, throughout the 1980s in the Independent. And this is now a book that is on sale outside, if you haven't already got it. I think he's as well known as a musician as a cartoonist. And again, he's never allowed the grass to grow beneath his feet in terms of what he's been collaborating with and producing. And he told me earlier that he collaborated with someone called the Golden Palominos, and I tried to look knowledgeable, but somebody in this audience might know. Yes, they were a great band. But they were kind of remote forms. And then recently, I was interested to learn that he actually collaborated with John Paul Jones of Led Zeppelin earlier this year, for which he's produced some of the lyrics and also the cover for John Paul Jones's new album. He used to play in the 1970s in a band called Faust, a very remote form, and for them he used to perform a hydraulic jackhammer on stage, which might explain some of his sort of lost memory. From then, he sort of evolved into a band called Henry Cow, and from there into Slap Happy. Now, these bands are kind of cult, but amazing amount of people who we trust instinctively know about them. Nick Hornby came here and was looking slightly kind of bored because he was in such a sort of lowly establishment, and then he discovered that Peter Blegvad had just walked out into the lift, and his eyes lit up. He's a big fan of Peter Blegvad. Jonathan Coe mentions one of Peter Blegvad's bands in the beginning of his latest novel, The Rotters Club. And so he's the sort of person that everybody knows about and is enjoying a kind of renaissance. And indeed, Slap Happy was revived, was brought out of hiding after 25 years and performed a superb concert in the Royal Festival Hall last year, which I attended. And I remember sitting in the audience behind a row of Hell's Angels, and I was talking to my friend about, you know, what I knew about Peter, like he's a friend, etc. And four of these Hell's Angels turned around and said, "There's something more interesting going on stage. Shut up." So his audience ranges from literary novelists to bikers from California. Tonight he's going to perform some short texts, some songs, and he's going to actually give us what I call the world premiere of his phenomenological studies. And with anything that Peter does, it's going to be an invention. So welcome, Peter Blegvad.
Thanks a lot. Thanks, Russell. Try and live up to some of it.
I thought I'd start by projecting. A strip about writing. Most of today's talk will be about writing. Who's buried here? Let's ask that ghost. This is my grave. I was a bard, so humiliated by the critics that I killed myself. Shall I tell you the story behind the curious inscription on my headstone?
Can you tell it economically and in rhyme?
Yes. Headlines in the tabloid press, bard writes themes with an extra S, which thus misspelled becomes the mess. My blunder made the nation laugh, the mess became my epitaph.
Stay,
he's fading away.
The punchline.
Don't say anything funny, Cat. We don't want people laughing at us.
You can count on me, Levi. Well, you can laugh at me. A lot of what I'm doing sounds like metaphysical speculation, but is actually intended to be humorous.
Years ago, I tore this illustration out of a magazine ad for the Rosicrucians, a mystical order with its headquarters in an Egyptian-style temple in San Jose, California. The ad didn't say so, but the image implied that once initiated, you too might become an armchair traveler, able to project yourself out of your body like the well-groomed shaman in the picture. He's a reader, at home with his books. And in my book, he's also a writer. Yeah, okay, he's me, idealized, as I'd like to be. For an adept like him, writing is both a descent, an initiation into dark mysteries, and an ascent, an out-of-body experience like astral travel. His writing is an escape, but one which takes nerve and endurance. J.R. Tolkien. What class of men would you expect to be the most preoccupied with and most hostile to the idea of escape? The answer, jailers. William Burroughs, the only way I can write narrative is to get right outside my body and experience it. This can be exhausting and at times dangerous. Among the books on his shelves, the man in the picture will have several about alchemy. The Rosicrucians are big on alchemy. But the man in the picture isn't interested in synthesizing the philosopher's stone, not really. He's more interested in how language can make a stone feel stony, which some say is the purpose of art. To him, alchemy is a metaphor for writing. Italo Calvino. Alchemy was first and foremost the technique of knowledge and the inner transformation of man carried out by means of a symbolic ritual transformation of matter. That's what the man in the picture is interested in, inner transformation. He adapts Calvino's sentence to read, writing is first and foremost the technique of knowledge and the inner transformation of the writer carried out by a ritual transformation of language. Now here's another ad, one you've probably seen, for a correspondence course for the Writers' Bureau. William Burroughs again. As a young child, I wanted to be a writer because writers were rich and famous. They lounged around Singapore and Rangoon smoking opium in a yellow pongee silk suit. They sniffed cocaine in Mayfair and they penetrated forbidden swamps with a faithful native boy and lived in the native quarter of Tangier, smoking hashish and languidly caressing a pet gazelle. Christina Jones of Abingdon. My first novel was accepted by Orion and sold over 200,000 copies. My second has been reprinted 5 times and my third will be published in July. My life has changed completely. I'm earning my living doing what I love, writing. The Writers Bureau made this possible. John Eagle of Essex. I was paid £25,000 advance for my novel. I have now also sold the film rights and will be co-writing the script. The success is thanks in no small part to the Writers Bureau. Well, good luck to them. I'm not here to sneer at anyone's achievements, but money is, for most of us, a good reason not to be a writer. You want to get rich by writing? Get real. I want to be a writer because I envy the writer's freedom to get unreal. The carte blanche, or poetic license of imagination, which allows the writer passage between worlds. I want to be a writer because a writer travels light, a pen, a notebook, and you're off. I want to be a writer because it's a solitary occupation, because writers have a godlike power to create and destroy, a child's exemption and permission to play, all of which makes it sound easy. But in fact, the main reason I want to be a writer is because writing has the aura around it of the impossible. Maurice Blanchot describes Flaubert's experience of writing as the practice of the impossible. And he asks, one works in order to make what? A work of literature that does not exist? A beautiful, unreal book? Not even that. A sentence, and a sentence that cannot be written. On the level of literature, the sentence, "he closed the door," is already impossible. The Writers' Bureau ad could be amusingly vandalized by replacing graduates' testimonies of quick results, personal fulfillment, and easy money with quotes from writers telling it like it is. Joseph Conrad, for instance. In the course of a working day of 8 hours, I write 3 sentences, which I erase before leaving the table in despair. Sometimes it takes all my resolution and power of self-control to refrain from butting my head against the wall. I want to howl and foam at the mouth, but I daren't do it for fear of waking the baby and alarming my wife. I owe it all to Writers' Bureau. Now here's an ad I'd answer. I can get out of my mind easily enough, God knows, but I have a frustrated urge to get out of my body as well. Doesn't everybody? Technology seems set on dissolving the body and may be able to satisfy this urge one day. We'll have virtual bodies which we'll be able to change as easily as a shirt or a pair of jeans. Flaubert writes of St. Anthony's longing to have wings, a carapace, a rind, to breathe out smoke, wave my trunk, twist my body, divide myself up, to be inside everything, to drift away with odors, develop as plants do, flow like water, vibrate like sound, gleam like light, curl myself up into every shape, to penetrate each atom, to get down into the depth of matter, to be matter. Have you seen that ad on TV for Levi Jeans, the freedom to move one, with the young couple running, racing each other, crashing straight through masonry, hurtling vertically up the trunks of giant fir trees and off into space? The ad's not just selling jeans, it's selling the immemorial dream of freedom from the limits of one's own corporeality, the spirit's dream of liberation. Well, writing is the spirit's way out, out of contingency and caducity, out of the body. Going through my notebooks, looking for things I might read tonight, I was surprised by how often I expressed a desire to dissolve or otherwise escape the body. Usually, it's a death wish, as in this one, for instance, called The New Man. After my third marriage collapsed in a messy and financially devastating divorce, I retired to a monastery and took a vow of silence. I embraced celibacy with an ardor I realized I'd never felt for my wives. Silence was no trial either. Sexual and social intercourse had brought me nothing but trouble. I was glad to be free. Years passed. abnegation before God and rigid adherence to a brutally ascetic regime so spiritualized me that one day, while pissing, my dick came off in my hand. Soon after, my tongue dissolved in my mouth like one of the sacramental wafers which formed the basis of my diet. With denial, tears, and holy water, I diluted my blood until it turned clear in my veins. Finally, my whole body dematerialized. No image remained to perturb the surface of my shaving mirror. I was pure spirit, with no more substance than a fume or a radio transmission. In my new guise, I decided to quit the monastery and surprise my ex-wives when they met at my lawyer's office, as they did on the first of every month, to collect their alimony checks. I wanted to apologize, to atone, perhaps when they saw how much I'd changed. Certainly, it was not my intention to scare them all to death, but then life's forever playing tricks like that. Here's another in which bodies dissolve. It's called Study in Negative, and it's told with as few positive assertions as possible, as you'll hear. I didn't want to be floating upside down, confronted by such awful scenes, but in the panic of the plane ditching in the sea, I hadn't noticed that my life jacket had been strapped on in such a way that in the water, my head would not stay up, nor my feet down. I wasn't thinking, if I get out of this alive, I'll write an angry letter to the airline. No. Phrases threatening legal action did not occur to me as I looked down through my waving tresses into the depths. While my feet kicked ineffectually in the air above, my head was about to burst, tightly encased in a medium inimical to the performance of vital tasks. All I wanted was to breathe. The vilest stink would have been sweet to me. I was not alone. A few yards below me, a spiral of rosy bubbles streamed from the mouth of a stewardess entangled in a variegated spaghetti of cables, belts, and hoses. She made no sound, but I didn't have to guess that the spiral of bubbles was a scream, its pink tint indicative of pulmonary hemorrhage. Pity wasn't an entirely new experience for me, but I'd never felt so much of it as I felt at that moment for the stewardess and myself. I hadn't been a recluse all my life exactly, but I'd somehow never really been touched in my exchanges with others. Not until the pilot had announced that we weren't going to make it. He said something I wouldn't have thought of under the circumstances. If you can't always get what you want, I hope you get what you need. Well, I didn't want to be floating upside down, confronted by such awful scenes, but maybe this was the shock I needed in order to finally wake up and be touched. I don't know. I can't be sure. Am I even alive at this point? Was I ever really alive? Posterity will deliver the verdict, and I won't care. Not even if they find me to have been dead my whole life. I'll have been long since distilled to salt with the stewardess and the rest. We'll have mingled particles in a union which, for all its vast dilution, will be more intimate than any known ashore. No longer part of the problem, will be part of the solution at last. Andrew Brown, writing in The Independent some years ago, a scientific experiment is underway at a coronary care unit in southern England to discover whether dead people can read. Dr. Peter Fenwick of the Institute of Psychiatry has arranged for messages to be placed near the ceiling of a coronary care unit which could only be seen by someone or their spirit who was actually hovering up there. The experience of nipping up to the ceiling, as he describes it, is commonly reported by patients believed to be dead in after-death experiences. Well, nipping up to the ceiling reminds me of this piece in which the narrator is trapped in his inert body. I tripped and fell. That was days ago. I haven't moved since. My body has turned to stone. I'm flat on the floor of my room staring at the ceiling, which I'd never noticed before. My unblinking gaze is fixed on a spot just to the left of a tasseled hanging lamp. Occasionally, a fly lands within my field of vision. I watch it walking upside down and envy its lightness and diminution. I used to be an explorer. I was rarely at home. On my journeys into uncharted territories, I never looked up. I'd concentrate my attention on what was underfoot. That was where the perils lay. I'd return to my room exhausted but unfulfilled, already planning my next expedition. The perils at home were all underfoot too. I never looked up, lest I trip over a rug or footstool, fall down an open trapdoor, or slip on a banana skin. All the while, overhead, was my own ceiling, a terra incognita, the only clean, uncluttered surface in the place. Dear God, if I ever walk again, please let it be upside down on the ceiling with the only obstacle, a tasseled hanging lamp. Well, a living thing trapped in an inert body might be waiting to hatch like a pupa in a cocoon. Not a death wish then, but a desire for inner transformation, for a new life, as is the case in this next piece. Stand back, all you bugs, this cocoon is gonna blow. I'm larval no longer, this butterfly is busting out. I've been cooped up in here, morphing, metamorphosing, metamorphosizing, and now it's time to unfurl my winged imago glory, to dry my painted wings in the warm currents of your admiration. Admiration dries my wings. The weight of universal acknowledgement presses out the wrinkles. Your jealousy of my achievement lifts me aloft to spread my soaring self abroad. I lord it over the insect kingdom. Countless compound eyes adore me. Forests of feelers palpate the air to savor my becoming. You used to call me pupa, the last to hatch. Now bow down, my apotheosis is at hand. Evacuate, my chamber can't contain me. In increments, by peristalsis, segment by segment, it defecates the accumulated glory of my finished self. Right, Inside a Gigantic Eye is a poem written from the point of view of someone or something waking up to find themselves trapped in a body, but at least the body is ambulatory. And here's a version of it. Inside a gigantic eye, looking out at passers-by, who are these colossal gods? I sit among the cones and rods and wonder in whose eye I am. He must be a god like them, to accommodate me thus, like a particle of dust. Until I'm at large again, restored to my own domain, at least I can enjoy the scene which pour in splendor through the lens and savor the circumference of an organ so immense. Mommy, why is that man crying?
Next piece.
Lacrima Bozo, the tears of a clown. Well, as happens occasionally, I write a poem, turn it into a cartoon strip, and then try and set it to music as well. So, feeling a little bit like Jasper Carrot, I'll now strap on the acoustic guitar and try and sing you a version. In fact, I didn't set this to music. Andy Partridge, a kind of Picasso of pop, famous for his 20-year career with XTC, wrote the music, which I can't really play, but I'll play. Inside a gigantic eye, looking out at passers-by, who are these colossal gods? I sit among the cones and rods and wonder in whose eye I am. He must be a god like them to accommodate me thus, like a particle of dust. Inside a gigantic eye.
at large again, restored to my own domain. At least I can enjoy the scene and speculate on what it means and savor the circumference of an organ so immense inside a gigantic
Thank you.
It's like a church here, you're not supposed to applaud. What I'm now doing is tuning the guitar to an open E major chord. Easier said than done.
Okay, here's another song. Let's Travel Light, a song I wrote about the spirit's pneumatic urge to quit the body. And I think I won't use a plectrum for this. Travel light, we leave our bodies behind. We won't need bodies, we'll be all in the mind. Let's travel light, let's fly by night, side by side in silence we'll climb, and we'll keep climbing till the end of time. Let's fly by night, our wavelength will be ultraviolet. Save your strength, let me be your pilot. This isn't virtual, it's real. It'll change the way you feel. I appeal with all my might. Let's travel light. Let's travel light. Let's travel light. Bodies behind, we won't need bodies, we'll be all in the mind. Let's travel light.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, well, obliquely related, I think, to this theme, but moving us along, I hope, Powers in the Air is a song about the romantic idea of the poet as a radio receiving transmissions from outside, from angels, in the case of Cocteau and Rilke, for instance, from spooks, Yeats, or from Martians, Jack Spicer.
Say someone stole a line from Ezra Pound. Who's to say it hadn't lay there for centuries, just waiting to be found? And he did not create it. He heard a voice dictating. In fact, all he did was write it down. 'Cause there are powers in the air, and they make all our choices. Powers in the air, with such seductive voices, pull up a chair. Now say, when we're surrounded, it seems like we're alone. But they're looking over every shoulder. We're always chaperoned. They infiltrate like vapor. They're thin as a piece of paper. And they can dance right through meat, steel, and stone. Yeah, they're the powers in the air. And they're gonna lay it on ya. Powers in the air. Well, don't say I didn't warn you. People beware. Now say your steps are shadowed by, you can't say what or whom. Just as you in turn pursue what you're helpless to subsume. All you know is it's the first thing you ever hungered for. You were thirsting for it, even as you were bursting from the womb. Now, 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 it's the powers in the air who bait us with abstractions. The powers in the air who divide us into factions. And once you've been snared, you're in the power of the powers in the air. Yeah, they're dragging you up by the hair. Beware the powers in the air.
Thank you very much.
Now, the fresh, spontaneous, improvised feel that the show has had so far is an illusion. This evening's program has been choreographed down to the last detail. I'll read you a bit of the original outline. I'll sing Powers in the Air, about the romantic idea of the poet as a radio receiving transmissions from outside. Well, we've done that. I'll mention psychologist Julian James, author of The Origins of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind, and explain how the left brain, the dominant hemisphere, is often characterized as the logical, verbal half, while the right brain is the spatial and imaginative half, which sees resemblances, metaphors, etc. Actually, James goes so far as to affirm that the right brain spoke and sang in our pre-literate ancestors' heads and was heard by them as God's voice. Schizophrenia was the norm then. And poetry, James says, is the descendant of the right brain voice. Well, okay, by reading it, we've done that too. Now, from hearing voices, it's not far to the project I'm working on now for Radio 3, which I'd very much like to test out on you. It's an audio cartoon, or ear tune, as I call it, and the name is Static in the Attic, in which I record my voice on two tracks in dialogue with myself. It could be my right brain talking to my left. Now, Dr. Jekyll says, "Man is not truly one, but truly two." Robert Louis Stevenson's character wanted to separate the two halves of his divided self. I want to get mine together around the microphone and hear what they have to say. And I had hoped to perform one of the parts of this recorded routine live for you here tonight, but I wasn't able to remix it all in time. So if you don't mind, I'll join you and we can listen together to an episode of Static in the Attic. It's only 4 minutes long, which happens to involve a spot of armchair travel. I think we'll go back to this one. Sort of sums everything up. Okay, play Static in the Attic. Done that. Even in company, there's a silent commentary going on between my ears, along with a mix of adhesive loops, tropes, and snatches, not unlike a collage of sound samples. Mostly subliminal, of course, otherwise I'd go mad. It's going on even now as I'm writing this, and will be going on as I stand before you reading it. The process of writing involves a lot of back and forth among the population of myself. And I thought I would read you a little piece about this phenomenon, which I'm sure you're all familiar with to a greater or lesser extent. "That cannot keep itself furious, that tantrum academy," Blocks called, whether a laughing stock or not. "New present accelerator with my last punch became keys to ever trust, or punching like watch crystal is see-through to calling it dirt, a track for carts." I'm not supposed to notice, just to let it flow, but this is contemporary writing as I naively think it should be, non-narrative, ambiguously denotative. Above all, I should not understand it, because then it might be like the modern poetry which I enjoy without understanding. But it's not even remotely where I live. Oh, yes, it is. Don't you recognize the Academy of Fury cooling and your fear of being laughed at? It's a self-portrait, so don't interrupt. Write. The purpose of it all will become apparent later. I'm not even supposed to stop and read over what I've written. But that's often where the momentum to continue comes from, so I cheat. An exercise like this, getting up at dawn to write the first things that come to me, suspending judgment, proves there are two of me, at least. Another voice, the judge I can't suspend, keeps breaking in to comment. And then the first voice, the writer, has to reassert himself, get us back on the track. For Cart? Did I say us? Do I see myself as a collective? Since childhood, an inner dialogue between a commanding officer and his men has been my habitual mode of self-address. About to undertake some chore or run some errand, I will combat inertia, boost morale, by addressing my forces, my limbs and faculties as a captain would his crew about to embark on a dangerous mission. I answer myself, too, as members of crew would their captain. Then I always say, "Sir." My person is the ship they man, a childish technique I have never tried to shake, which attempts to glamorize life by casting it as a war movie. English rather than American. Sink the Bismarck is the paradigm. The conflict, I imagine, is always World War II. When I'm drawing, the relentless inanity of this interior exchange can become unbearable. Perhaps because drawing is a non-verbal activity, there's more scope for chatter. If the work is going well, the battle intensifies, casualties mount, the Germans are throwing everything they have at us, and the commander snaps his orders to the men through a speaking tube from the bridge in clipped, unruffled Oxbridge tones. A rating comes forward. "Excuse me, sir, but the hand we've just drawn has six fingers." "Right, Brinks," or some such name. "Stand by to erase the offending digit." "Yes, sir." Brinks salutes smartly. It's enough to drive you, me, us mad. Right, well, now we get to the serious part of the show. Well, not that serious, but it's a bit of an experiment, and I hope it won't totally alienate everybody. This is my kind of pseudo-Coleridge phenomenological experiment with perception. And as Russell mentioned, this piece is called Memory Failure and Imagination. And it's part of the Imagined, Observed, Remembered project I began in 1976, an attempt to shed light on the murky world of interior vision. Is inner vision transparent to itself? Will mental imagery submit to interview? Investigation of these questions is hampered by a kind of uncertainty principle. As Sartre says, we can't verify the mental image at the same time as we're producing it. But the challenge is somehow irresistible to me. While we don't receive mental images through the retina, it's not purely metaphorical to say that we see pictures in the mind's eye. Mental imagery is processed by the same part of the brain that deals with vision. As long as your visual cortex is intact, you'll have mental imagery even if you were born blind. Asleep, with our eyes wide shut in pitch darkness, we dream images which likewise bloom in the visual cortex. Artists work from memory and imagination as readily as from observation. The following experiment is, first of all, an attempt to observe the image of an object remembered over time as my memory of it fails, to document the process of this failure. But it's also intended to be a practical demonstration of the symbiosis between forgetting and imagining. Imaginative vision involves a failure of memory in that we can't really see anew until we forget what we know. The experiment has four stages. One, the object is observed. A drawing is made from life, or in this case, from a photograph, to imprint it on a memory. The object and the drawing are then concealed from view. Two, time passes. Three, the object remembered is depicted at intervals, a record of drift and attrition. Four, over sufficient time with sufficient drift, the object gradually becomes more imagined than remembered. Does the resultant distortion constitute an imaginative vision of the object? I hope to demonstrate that it does. In everyday life, the perceptual and conceptual functions of the mind work in concert to create a coherent picture of the world from fragments of data. This process is automatic, unconscious. In order to depict a failure of memory with any degree of accuracy, therefore, one must first learn to disable or distract the conceptual function. Only then is one able to see in the mind's eye the lacunary image of the thing imperfectly recalled in fragments, without its being unified, filled in, and airbrushed or idealized to fit a conceptual model. From a practical point of view, the degree to which a memory departs from its source is seen, understandably, as loss or failure. But from a creative standpoint, a memory can be thought of as evolving, undergoing metamorphosis, until, like a word in a game of Chinese whispers, it is more imagined than remembered, at which point it has become an independent image, autonomous, no longer a record or reflection of something else. Drawing a lion from memory. First, before exposing myself to the image of a caged lion, I tried to draw one as realistically as I could. Now, the whole point of doing this lecture is to use one of these. Figure one. There it is. Fantastic. So, it's a record of the innocence I was about to lose. Working from this photograph, found in an old encyclopedia, I drew this image of a recumbent lion. 6 months later, I tried to recreate it from memory. I aborted this first attempt when I realized that whenever I experienced a failure of recall, as I frequently did, the missing detail would be filled in automatically by other memories in the constellation of knowledge of which my memory of the lion observed, somewhere up there, was a part. Whatever attrition and drift the image might have sustained over the past 6 months, it was hidden under bits of other lions and felines in general, remembered. In my second attempt, figure 5, therefore, I concentrated on isolating the specific image I wanted, my memory of the lion observed. Unless I could see a detail in my mind's eye, I left it out or indicated its absence with cross-hatching, a cloud of unknowing. Ears, nose, mouth, hind legs have all drifted off, but the sphinx-like creature with front paw extended in figure 5 is still recognizably a reflection of the lion observed, if you remember it. The bars of the cage with patches of foliage behind have also proved adhesive. Figure 6. 2 years later, the details have dissolved, leaving only a vague impression of hindquarters, front paw, mane, and the distinctive head, like the outline of a skull. Despite, or perhaps because of its economy, the result is a surprisingly legible sign for lion. However, the beast now points with its paw to the right. I've long been haunted by an incipient dyslexia. Reversed orientation is a common failure of memory, which, like a mirror, reverses right and left, but never up and down. Figure 7. This curious variant was produced a few days after drawing figure 6, and here the ambiguity of orientation expresses itself in a doubling or mirroring of the few details, head, mane, and extended paw, which I remembered most vividly. Brightness is again used to indicate clarity of recall, but the mane is now luminous, an aura, evidence that imagination is now participating to a greater extent in the creation of the image. Figure 8. Experts agree every act of imagination involves a degree of amnesia. As senility encroaches and memory fails, I console myself with Blake. Imagination has nothing to do with memory. With Nietzsche, in order to create, it's necessary to forget. And with Paul Valéry, to see something truly is to forget its name. October 2001. 15 months since drawing the double lion in figure 7. By now enough has been forgotten for imagination to seize the reins from memory. In figure 8, the bars are gone, though the lion is by no means free. The image is still the product of constraining influences from a constellation of sources. What's different is that imagination has combined these to produce a drawing which makes us look twice. In the first of these two looks, before we recognize, we see. As William James points out, the taste for emotions of recognition, based on remembering, is countered or accompanied by the taste for emotions of surprise, based on forgetting. Amnesia is selective. Discovery of the often unconscious criteria by which we select certain memories to suppress while sparing others is usually the province of psychoanalysis, but the practice of art also brings these occult processes to light. Consider Pessoa. My vision of things always suppresses in them that which my dreams cannot use. Sometimes the best way to see an object is to annihilate it, but it still subsists. How, I have no idea, but made out of the very matter of its negation and abolition. It seems to me that the forgetting involved in the production of the lion in figure 8 was, at least on some level, an editing or annihilating process with a criteria not dissimilar to Pessoa's. The lion's head or face is involved in a constellation of its own. Figure 9, detail of figure 8. Its form is influenced by, among other things, an Amerindian glyph from a book of symbols, by images of skulls and radiant suns like these, and unexpectedly, by a drawing of pants on fire, illustrating a review of a book about lying, which I recently drew for the New York Times. Now, the near identical sound of lion and lion is suggestive, but I'm not sure of what. But it does suggest a song. Two songs, in fact, with which I'll finish the performance. The first one is called Lying Again, or Lion Again, if you prefer. Ah, but I have to tune this down again. I think I'll do this properly with this little box here, which tells me that I'm tone deaf. Almost done. Lion again, yes. Plectrum or not plectrum? I think not plectrum. I wander round in a daze. I wonder what my skeleton weighs, and what instruments it plays. But I don't want pity from you. I don't want anything from you. Oh no, there I go. I think I'll pack and leave this town. I've had nothing but bad luck since I set my suitcase down. But thanks for coming round. You ask what I do with my time. Well, it gets killed or wasted, but that's not a crime. Oh no, there I go. I'm lying again. Sing me to sleep. Come on, you angel. Sing me to my rest. Perchance to sleep. To sleep forever might be best. It might be. You say you only want to see your old friend smile. Well, can you stay? 'Cause
it may take a while. I know I'm acting like a child, but I don't feel any shame. It's not as if I were to blame. Oh no, there I go. It says wisdom on my toothbrush and revelation on my bag. But I can't put two words together. Feel like I'm bound and gagged. I don't like to brag, but I once was a great raconteur. Cold silence is just what I've grown to prefer. Oh no, there I go. I'm lying again. Oh no, there I go. I'm lying again.
Thank you kindly. One more song. This is a very Dylan-esque, long sort of narrative song. Which I always thought of as a kind of story of somebody, the evolution of a writer. And it ties in with Lion, because you'll notice in the third verse, the early technique that the protagonist, King Strut, his name is, develops for training himself as a writer is learning how to dream and learning how to lie. These are the two important things. Okay. It's a little out of tune, I'd say. King Strut was just a baby back in 1951. His howls woke the neighborhood. They had his parents done for negligence or cruelty, I forget which one. And the state took custody of their sickly son. Well, no one ever dreamed that one day he'd become King Strut. Short of temper, highly strung, with a shadow on his lung, King Strut flew off the handle if his vanity was stung. He could cut a foe to pieces, using nothing but his tongue, and a technical vocabulary vast for one so young. Throughout the noisy orphanage, his name was widely sung, King Strut. Imagination, like a muscle, will increase with exercise. King Strut developed his by having dreams and telling lies. He'd describe a situation or a piece of merchandise. He could summon it from nothing to appear before your eyes. Who was that masked man? Why was he in disguise? King Strut. A man without a moral code is just an appetite. King Strut was on a diet, growing luminous by eating light. He left the institution under cover of the night and was looking for employment
answering to Dwight. Sleeping in a doorway, minus 20 Fahrenheit, His Majesty. Dwight Strutt. Yeah, he sheltered under cardboard above a subway vent, and one night took in the victim of a suspicious accident. As dawn came up, he knew the man's death was imminent. The man called out a number. King Strutt asked him what it meant. It meant the man had something valuable he wanted to present King Strutt. Well, some say it was a diamond, like the crown jewel Kohinoor, or a talisman empowered by an ancient conjurer. A hot tip or a claim check, no one knows for sure. All we know is King Strutt changed overnight from being poor to being an authority. Philanthropist, connoisseur who paid for what he wanted with a simple signature. The homeless, they worked for him to pay their rents, and they recruited others to help spread his influence. He fed 100 million hungry at his own expense. Popes and potentates applied and were denied an audience. He's got too damn many dollars, they said. Not enough sense, King Strutt. A man believes his dreams are real. He's said to be deranged. His dreams are compensation for the things he cannot change. A man can be in slavery. He doesn't have to be in chains. He's waving out the window and the infirmary's in flames. But instead of crying fire, he pronounced the name of names. King Strutt. King Strutt. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.